Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Robert Yunke. I'm here representing NRDC and the Sierra Club in this matter today. We have 3 points that we would like to cover this morning. The first is with respect to Chevron Step 1. We believe that EPA's interpretation of the statute as it was adopted by the agency in the rulemaking is fully consistent with the position that petitioners have taken, and that it is a correct interpretation of the statute. Now, it's a bit different than the interpretation offered by government counsel in the briefs, but we believe that EPA's initial understanding of what the statute requires is correct. But with regard to the rule itself, the rule does not implement EPA's interpretation of the statute.
What did we say about Chevron Step 1 to which you're responding? What did we say in the previous round?
In the last case, Your Honor, what the court looked at was the fact that EPA had not offered any explanation for why it had omitted subsection B3 from the regulatory requirements.
Pardon? Not a step one problem, failure to explain. That's a step two problem. Chevron, right? What did we say? You're saying they're both step one, and you've made both step one and step two arguments in your brief.
Well, I think that, yes, Your Honor.
So where's the step one error in this case before? What are you responding to?
Well, what we're responding to is the fact that the agency, for the first time, has interpreted B3 in this rulemaking. They didn't interpret it in the rulemaking that was remanded in 2007. The question in that case was why the agency didn't address B3, and the court remanded it to say, "Well, okay, it's time to address it."
All right. So you're not reading the remand as having necessarily encompassed Step one. It's just that whatever the reason for the remand, the EPA, when they came up with the new regulation, ran afoul of the plain, or not the plain, but the text itself, the word, the statute itself. Step one.
The rule itself is in conflict with the statutory requirements, and what we're saying to start with is that we believe that in the rulemaking, EPA correctly interpreted the statute, but then did not adopt the rule that tracks what the agency itself said the statute requires.
I'm sorry, correctly interpreted the statute in the sense of saying, yes, B3 is there, and it means there should be no delay, right? It also says that as it has construed B1 and 2, once they are applied, there is no further problem with B3. Right? So there's no need for it
that
application of this to be considered independently.
And that's where we believe the agency hasn't adequately considered the facts.
Because you read B3, if I read what you say correctly, you read B3 as saying that it is satisfied if and only if the original deadlines set by Congress will be met, notwithstanding the project.
That the emissions from the project will not continue to cause violations after the statutory deadline.
Right. Now, the EPA has, by contrast, applied this build, no build alternative.
And yes.
It asks the question, it says that it asks the question, whether or not the project will create a delay beyond the delays which existed, would have existed, under the no-build alternative, right?
And the basic...
That's what they say. I'm just asking you, if you agree with me, proposition, that's what they say.
Yes.
Okay, so that's what they say. And then the question is, why is that wrong?
Well, let me first quote what they say about the statute. Their interpretation is, quoting, a project could not be found to conform if its emissions caused or contributed to a future NAAQS violation, end quote. And that's at 14.281, column 1 of the Federal Register Notice.
They have a lot more, because they've construed B1 and B2 in a dynamic way so that they compare not just events the minute the project is completed or something like that, but they look at the trajectory of emissions.
But what they essentially do, Your Honor, if you look at the hotspot guidance that the agency issued as the clearest statement of how they intend to apply this provision, in the guidance, which we've included in the addendum at page 129, there are two bullets about the analysis. The first bullet requires an analysis that would look at all the emissions from the project. So, for example, in the case that we discussed in the briefs, the SR-47 project in Los Angeles, what you have is four lanes that currently exist as an arterial street that carry about 11,000 trucks per day. It's a Henry Ford.
Can we focus on the actual challenge regulation, right? Because
yes, and
that seems to be what we have before us.
The regulation, the fault in the regulation occurs in sentence 4 of section 116A, which says that the project will not be held accountable for emissions from the project so long as the additional emissions from an expanded project are accounted for. So it doesn't require the project to be held accountable for all the emissions for the project. That's why this example, I think, is really important to help the court understand how this gets applied.
Yeah, what I understand, and I seem to be having a hard time putting my finger on the exact part of the appendix where we have the explanation given in 1993, but it lays out the build, no build comparison, and it looks as if under that, what the EPA is to do in applying this regulation is to compare the trajectory of ambient air, really, the trajectory of ambient air at the relevant spot if the project did not go forward versus if the project does go forward. And that seems to me, with a possible qualification, to be a way in which its reading of B1 and B2, which is not the only reading of B1 and B2 possible, makes satisfaction of them also satisfy B3.
But the reason why it doesn't satisfy B3 is because it allows emissions from the expanded project that would cause violations of the ambient standard after the deadline to continue without being reduced.
No,
and that's...
But no violations, no incremental violations, right?
The question is whether or not the question is whether or not all the emissions from the project are held accountable. If you look back to the 1993 rule in section 123C1.
That seems to me a somewhat arbitrary way of trying to look at it. The EPA seems to have
looked at this in terms of, and
this seems to me what B is aimed at, the net result. And the net result, they seem to be saying, is that in order to meet B1 and B2, you have to pursue the same declining trajectory that would have been the case on the no-build alternative. You say that's not good enough. You say it's not good enough because it may mean that there is delay beyond the original congressional attainment deadline. But by hypothesis, under the EPA's reading of B1 and B2, there was going to be such a delay, regardless of the project.
Your Honor, in the 1993 rule, the rule itself says that the conformity analysis should estimate pollutant concentrations based on the, quote, total emissions burden which may result from implementation of the project, not just from the new lanes that are added in a corridor, but all the emissions from the project once it is expanded. And in 123C2, it says specifically the hotspot analysis must include the entire project. So not just the expanded portion of the project, but all the emissions from the project. And that's where B3 comes into play, because B3 adds something beyond B1 and B2. That's the whole point of the canons of statutory construction that we discussed in the opening brief.
You say at a very early stage of your reply brief, the bottom of page 1, the failure to require that expanded projects eliminate all the NOx qualifications by the attainment deadline defeats the fundamental congressional purpose. That, as I understand it, is the core of your position.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
And you are saying that EPA cannot, under Chevron, read B1, 2, and 3 for a less draconian proposition.
Well, first of all, you start with the statutory text, which specifically refers to not delaying attainment. So violations of the ambient standard that occur after the attainment deadline will delay attainment.
Yes, but in the no-build alternative, we're also going to go beyond attainment.
That's the point I'm not understanding in your analysis. In the no-build situation, there are circumstances where you're going to go beyond attainment.
Yes.
So the government is answering the question with respect to the new project with that in mind.
But what Congress was addressing here was specifically the situation where you're investing federal money in new projects and wanting to make sure, this was part of the point that was made in the EDF-2 decision, that when federal funds are invested in transportation projects, that it's not contributing to violations that occur after the deadline.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Are you meaning to suggest that the new, if we're in a situation where there is no new project and you're going to go beyond attainment, we're just going to go beyond that date, that when the new project comes in, it has to guarantee that all of it will be within the attainment date now? They have to cure what would otherwise occur?
They have to cure what is related to the project, and it's what the 1993 rule specifically speaks to is to look at all the emissions from the new project.
I honestly just don't understand what that means. If you're beyond attainment without the new project, with respect to the new project? To bring everything back in order?
If you hold the entire...
I think that you want to say yes to that, correct?
Yes. Yes, I'm sorry.
How do you read delay, timely delay in attainment, because there already was going to be a delay in attainment without the project?
Because what EPA adopted in 1993 was the correct interpretation of the statute, which held the total emissions burden of the new project accountable for its impact on ambient violations. So in this example provided...
impact, that's the whole point. It can't be held responsible for what was already amiss. If you were already going to go beyond the attainment date without the new project, then how can you conceptually say that the new project has caused the prior failure?
Because the emissions from the new project will continue to cause violations after the attainment deadline, when the investments
not,
made
not
in the new project.
Not if the scoring is dynamic, which is what the EPA in its explanation of the no-build methodology seems to be saying.
Well, this new project that's going to be added next to Henry Ford Boulevard in Los Angeles is going to add 6 lanes next to 4 lanes. Those 6 lanes are going to basically carry all the trucks they're going to shift onto that, and it's going to double the trucks from 11,000 a day to 22,000 a day. And if you look at EPA's hotspot analysis requirement, it only requires that project to be accountable for the ambient violations that result from the 11,000 new trucks and not from all the emissions from the project. And that's the key point here, is that here's a project that is going to carry 22,000 trucks. And to the extent that some of those emissions are going to be mitigated for the first 11,000 trucks, but not the other 11,000, it's still emissions from that project that are going to cause violations after the attainment deadline.
That just doesn't follow the last sentence.
Yeah.
If you've got 11,000 trucks and you add 11,000 more trucks and you take away the emissions from the second set of 11,000, you're back where you started before the incremental project.
In terms of emissions?
Yeah.
But it's still the emissions from the remaining 11,000 trucks are occurring on that project.
And that would occur whether they build the extra lanes or not.
Right.
Right. That's true, right? You don't disagree on that. That would.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So you're saying when there's an expansion, there's an obligation not just to make sure that it's neutral or helpful, but rather to make sure that it undoes whatever damage the previous.
I'm going to hear your answer again.
Well, this is the position that the agency took in 1993 when it adopted a rule requiring that the total emissions burden of the new project, additional emissions.
Yeah, and I understand that you're wedded to whatever you thought the original interpretation was, but an agency is not so bound unless there's a plain error violation. So, maybe they did, maybe they didn't. But the point is, as Judge Williams said a while ago, we have to look at what they've done now. You can point to an inconsistency and say this shows its irrationality, but it doesn't guarantee anything beyond that. They're not wrong because they've changed their mind, if in your view they've changed their mind. I'm not sure that's what happened, but that doesn't make them wrong. It's a matter of law.
No, Your Honor, but what they haven't done then is to explain why they've changed their mind. They've adopted a different position in this rule. They've not explained why these provisions as written would no longer be implemented through the guidance that they've issued. Those are fundamentally arbitrary and capricious.
For your time, Mr. Yonke, thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm David Kaplan, the Department of Justice, representing the Environmental Protection Agency today. The same basic issue that petitioners raised today has been raised on numerous occasions in this court. Each instance, it's been raised by the same counsel.
But not resolved.
It has been resolved, Your Honor, in the context of other elements of conformity, such as plans and programs. And the court there has said, no, conformity does not require that a new project achieve reductions to offset emissions from previously existing sources. And that's exactly what the argument Mr. Yonke was making today, that for the new project to go forward, conformity, and here he's talking about the hotspot conformity requirement, requires reductions to offset the previously existing sources. And EPA has taken a consistent interpretation under the build-no-build provision since 1993 when it established that test in 93.123C. And EPA did not revisit that text in this rulemaking. And so it's important to realize that this is a narrow rulemaking in which the court identified a narrow issue, sent it back to EPA for further explanation, did not require a change in the agency's criteria. And EPA fully explained both the hypothetical that concerned the court, and in that circumstance, EPA explained that hypothetical would not occur, in fact, because such a project wouldn't conform. And EPA also explained how B3 does operate. The simple point is that with regard to B3, if you've got a circumstance under the build-no-build test in which the new project will not cause or contribute to a new violation or cause an existing violation to be worse, EPA is not aware of any circumstance in which that project could delay timely attainment.
Suppose it, you confronted a case where, in fact, contrary to your anticipation, a project conformed with B1 and B2, but nonetheless violated B3.
Well, analytically, we don't understand how that could be. We don't.
Well, let's just suppose.
Well, I'll say I don't know. I can't answer that question, Your Honor, because it's not been presented to the agency in this rulemaking, in comments to the agency. All that's been presented is a scenario in which the concern is that the pre-existing sources. And so
I understand that in a way you're confronted with
you're
confronted with a different problem in this litigation.
Yeah.
But it's still, frankly, I can't think of scenarios in which compliance with B1 and B2 nonetheless leave inconsistency
right.
with B3. They're probably very remote, but in any event, it would be nice to hear that the EPA, confronted with such a remote possibility, would respond by looking at the broad sentence which says, yes, B3 is really part of this, rather than resting entirely on the other sentence.
Well, EPA did include B3 in the test
right.
and edit there. Well, it included in the language of B6 of 116, but we believe it's a nullity, and analytically we think it's a nullity, and so there's always an opportunity to petition EPA if they send, hey, we've been looking at the world wrong, here's a strange set of facts that we think captures it.
Well, that's an interesting answer. What if simply the facts on the ground show the hypothetical that in a particular case, show the hypothetical that I'm raising. Are you saying that the council will be barred from raising this issue?
Again, we're talking about a nullity, but if somehow, and an analytic nullity and a factual nullity, but if some strange circumstances are overlooked, I'm not suggesting that they can go around the regulation in a district court case. The regulations stand, but they could then petition EPA.
Why can't you, I don't know how to think about it precisely, but why isn't it possible to delay without reference to the emissions that frequency and severity adding to violations? We're not going to add to any violations. Frequency of severity is the same, but there will be a delay.
Well, because, Your Honor, it's the robustness of the build-no-build test that shows that the project that requires conformity, we're looking at it, will it add something above and beyond? So
I'm just talking about delay now, apart from the effects
right.
and emissions.
Well, the concept of delay suggests that we're talking about delaying something that would otherwise occur. It's got to be a delay beyond what would otherwise occur. Mm-hmm. And so if you don't have a violation, whether it be a new one or contributing to a new one or increase the severity, how would you, if you're not making air quality worse by the project, how could you possibly delay a time attainment that would otherwise occur? And so that's the logic the agency went through. Plus, attainment is logically understood in terms of violations, and that's how attainment is helped to be defined. And so there's both an analytic and a factual nullity component to the EPA's explanation.
Can I ask you just momentarily to suspend disbelief?
Okay.
Assume that the hypothetical that I allude to mm-hmm. comes to pass. You're saying that the opponents of the project in that context are reduced to petitioning for a rulemaking to change the rule to correct this? Why can't they argue that as applied to this particular project, there's an ambiguity or contradiction in the EPA test, and that the EPA should resolve it in a way which makes sure that all three prongs are satisfied?
Well, Your Honor, I understand the question, but I think it's kind of textbook that if the EPA went through a rulemaking here and entertained comment and looked at both legal reasonings as well as factual circumstances and came up with a rule to apply nationwide. And so if something was missed that wasn't raised in this rulemaking, the hypothetical that we can't imagine.
I'm framing it as either an ambiguity or a self-contradiction in the rule.
Your Honor, I am hard-pressed to admit to a district court challenge.
Bear with me.
I understand, but the statute says you can't, in a district court case, challenge a reg that was promulgated and challengeable in this court.
Challenging is different from saying that one fork of the regulation contradicts another fork, and that when in this, let's assume, very peculiar set of circumstances, the specific interpretation of B3 standing alone contradicts the total picture, the EPA must look at that self-contradiction and resolve it in a way that's consistent with statutory purpose.
Well, certainly.
It's a pretty modest
claim. Well, it's very difficult when I can't imagine the hypothetical, but it's certainly true that if an issue that's not been addressed here and resolved comes up regarding regulations, and there's ambiguity in the text of the regs, the agency will endeavor to interpret. But I can't, so I grant that much for sure. Yeah,
I
think
that's the reassurance I was hoping to extract from.
And that's there in general, for sure, Your Honor.
What you're essentially arguing for is a change in the statute so that at the end of subsection 1, there's an or, and at the end of subsection 2, there's an and thus. That's the interpretation you're asking for. And that's not the statute.
I'm not.
That's why Judge Williams is
well, not exactly. No.
I'm asking, is that your interpretation? You seem to be saying one, cause or contribute, blah blah blah, or
yes,
increase, and thus delay timely attainment.
Your Honor.
I'm asking.
If the question is,
is that your interpretation of the statute?
Under different circumstances regarding different types of conformity elements, it may play out differently, I don't know. However, here, with the no-build test, the conditions under that test that satisfy I and double I will invariably satisfy triple I.
All right, let me try it again. But, I want you to answer my question, okay?
Okay.
In this case, whatever that means to you, what's before us, okay? Are you saying that in this case, the proper reading of the statute is, after you read one, it's or, and then two, and then following that is, and thus, delay timely attainment?
No, Your Honor. I think that it's not, it's the regulation itself and the analysis the agency does that incorporating a build, no build test that makes, that creates the factual situation in which if you meet one
and two.
Tell
me what you're doing with three then. What does three mean?
Three?
Are you saying three is simply a nullity? Because I don't know how else.
It's not a nullity. When Congress enacted the three parts, EPA hadn't yet established the build, no build test. And so EPA did a rulemaking, and it's a robust test. And EPA did a rulemaking in which it created a robust mechanism to look at what new emissions will result from the project in context, above and beyond pre-existing situations. And it realized that using that test, if the conditions under I and double I are met, three will be met as well. It doesn't render three a surplusage. It just means that this is a robust.
I understand you. There are plenty of interpretations of B1 and B2 under which they would come nowhere near satisfying B3. But EPA happened to choose a very demanding and, as I say, dynamic reading of B1 and B2 such that they satisfy B3.
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
And thus?
Thus you've satisfied B3 in through another formula without it operating independently while Congress, not knowing how you would come out on B1 and B2, put it in separately.
Yeah. Your Honor, the petitioner has suggested that the agency has changed its interpretation, and I want to assure the court EPA has not done so. In their reply, they've pretty much used the word project in a confusing way. They want project to mean both the modification plus the pre-existing structure. And the regs, the definitions established in 1993, established that the item that's up for conformity is either a project to implement a new structure that's not been built before completely, or to do the modification to that structure. And what I'm referring to, Your Honor, is the definition of at 93.101, the definition of highway project or transit project. And it makes it clear that it's the increment added by the new addition, the new enhancement alone that needs to be conformed. And that's an issue that they raised just on reply. They can't challenge those definitions. Those were established back in 1993. It wasn't raised in their opening brief, wasn't raised in the rulemaking. It wasn't raised by this court on the prior remand. And so the basis for their argument now in reply can't be raised before this court. Your Honor, the final point I'll make is they say that the agency is engaging in post hoc rationalization and regarding our statutory construction to support EPA's interpretation. And that's not the case. And I just want to point out that on page 4 of the first full paragraph, they actually concede the validity of the agency's interpretation. And I'll just quote, violations
page 4 of the
reply. Yes, Your Honor. It's the first sentence of the first full paragraph. Violations from other sources are a failure of the SIP process and should be remedied by revising the SIP. that's an acknowledgement by them that if their concern are pre-existing sources that are already causing trouble, it's the those are what EPA referred to as other sources, pre-existing. They are the pre-existing sources. The remedy is the, under the statutory structure is the SIP process, and it's an extensive process, and we've briefed it there.
The explanation in the brief is certainly more lucid than the agency's explanation. In answering the hypothetical that Judge Rogers left in the prior opinion, I mean, I don't see that clarity in the regulations. Can we defer your?
Well, I cited the parts in the brief. I don't have at my fingertip the page, so I'll look for it. But the point EPA made that does respond to the court's hypothetical was that mitigation measures that are pre-existing would be considered in the build-no-build test. So if you've got a mitigation measure that's already slated to occur, already has occurred, because we're still projecting forward, that would be considered in the no-build test. And so you would ensure that way that if it turns out that we're already taking into account mitigation, that the new project, when added on top
and
of that,
you're saying your brief's amplification is a natural outgrowth of what the agency said?
With regard to that hypothetical, yes.
Because it's certainly not the same. But you're saying it flows naturally.
Yes, Your Honor.
Just clear-headed when you looked at it and did it.
Yes, Your Honor. Your Honors, if you have no further questions, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kaplan. Mr. Yonke, give you 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, in response to Judge Edwards' point here, the government has made a number of arguments in the briefs that they didn't make in the rulemaking. One of which was that the SIP process will address the violations that are associated with existing highways. And EPA conceded in both the 2006 rulemaking and the recent 2010 rulemaking that they do not expect the SIP to address the violations from existing highways, and that they are specifically relying upon conformity to address those violations. And that's why their interpretation that they agreed with us on page 14281, I think, is particularly telling here, that they agreed that the project shall not cause or contribute to violations, to future violations. Now, the project, as counsel suggests here, is only the new portion of the project. But the reason why no one challenged the 1993 regulations is because those regulations correctly interpreted the statute to address the total emissions burden, which is the phrase from the 1993 rule, of a project. The total emissions burden is not just...
The project is the incremental point now, the incremental build.
It's the total project.
So let's use two different words, okay? Let's use facility or source, as the agency does, for the existing highway, say. And the project, which is up for approval, is the incremental build.
The project that is up for approval is, according to the rule, the entire expanded facility. It is not just the... If you look at the definition in Section 123CB1, sub 1 and sub 4, it refers to both new projects and expanded projects.
I take it you can point us to that. Where is it?
In the...
the tabbed volume?
Yes, it is on page 50 of the addendum.
50.
50.
The addendum, not the joint appendix.
The addendum, correct. That's the existing rule. And it refers to both new projects and expanded highway projects. And when that is read together with subsection C of the same rule, where it refers on the same page, it refers to estimated pollutant concentrations must be based on the total emissions burden which may result from the implementation of the project. When you're dealing with the example that we've used, the SR-47, the project is the new six lanes, the new diesel expressway that's going to attract a lot more trucks into that corridor. It's the emissions from the entire new facility. It is a new facility. And the fact that it happens to add emissions in the same corridor where trucks, some of those trucks used to travel, doesn't really justify treating them differently. If that highway had been moved over two blocks into a residential street where the diesel trucks never traveled, then all of the emissions from that expressway would have to be accounted for. And what council is arguing here is that if you move the highway next to an existing arterial street where some of the trucks used to travel, even though they're now going to use the new expressway, you only account for the new trucks being drawn into that corridor and not all the truck emissions.
That's certainly not the way I understand the rules. I understand the rule. You look at, repeat the terms, the build, no build comparison. And the no build comparison is, on your hypothetical, the four lanes charging along before, and the build comparison is all six lanes charging along, right? And why is that bad?
Well, when you look at that page from the guidance that I pointed you to earlier, it was page 129 in the addendum.
I want to go back to page 50 because I was way behind you on that.
What you see there are two bullets, Your Honor, in the guidance. The first bullet requires an analysis of all the emissions from the new highway, from the new expressway in the SR-47 example. And then if there are violations of the ambient standard that result from that analysis, then you're allowed to go on to the second bullet, the second step, which subtracts from the first analysis the trucks that would have been traveling on Henry Ford Boulevard, even though all the trucks now are basically traveling on the expressway. So the emissions from the expressway are not held accountable for all of their impacts. Now, if the highway were moved over two blocks, it would be.
I'm really completely lost. We have one set of four lanes, another set of six lanes, and the construction of the six lanes entails the removal of the four lanes. And
you say
that's
removal from the traffic on the arterial roads.
The traffic would shift from the arterial because it has stop and go.
They're going through the neighborhoods now, and they're going to get a dedicated expressway later.
Actually.
So they come off the small roads and go onto the expressway.
Okay. So the trucks are in a different place now.
Cheek by jowl, the six lanes are next to the four lanes. They're running through.
But the four lanes have, the trucks have moved.
But wait a minute. The six lanes are next to the four lanes only when they get built.
When they get built,
the
if they're approved.
The traffic is now on the six-lane truckway is coming from somewhere else. It's not
from the
incremental traffic. It's moved traffic. Right?
Right.
It's just relocated traffic.
Plus, it's drawing a lot of other traffic from other arterial streets because it's now an expressway without stoplights.
The no-build test looks at the increment in traffic.
Step one on that page 129 looks at all the emissions from the new expressway. all six lanes, all the 22,000 trucks that are expected to use the expressway. But then if that analysis shows that there will be ambient standard violations after the attainment deadline, then they're allowed to deduct the 11,000 vehicles that would have used Henry Ford Boulevard because it's in the same alignment. And the new project is only held accountable for the additional 11,000 trucks. Whereas if that highway were moved over two blocks, where the Henry Ford Boulevard traffic is not affecting the same receptors, which is where the analysis is conducted, then that project would be held accountable for all 22,000 vehicles because it would be treated then as not having a no-build contribution to be deducted. And what we're saying is it doesn't make sense to treat these facilities differently depending on whether or not they happen to be in an area that has some existing emissions or not, that they should be treated the same, and that their impacts...
So that's the argument in your reply brief, the disparity. That doesn't appear anywhere in your opening brief.
Because we weren't faced with the same kind of argument that we got from the government counsel.
That's a point you might have made in your opening brief in any event, right? There's nothing about their argument that puts something new on the table. This point about disparity is a point you might have made from the outset.
Well, I think that, yes, the point about disparity was new, but the explanation of how the rule worked and what its how it offended the statute was fully laid out in the opening brief. This is an example of one of the consequences of that. But it's not as if we're making a new argument that the rule is wrong in the reply brief that we didn't make in the opening brief.
The disparity argument was raised with the agency?
The disparity argument was...
It was not.
Your Honor, it was raised in the context of providing an example of how... the rule operated differently, but the word disparity was not used.
You used the whole SR 147 as an example, or 47 example, in your blue brief, right? Except for this disparity.
And in the
except
comments.
For the disparity point. You laid out everything you wanted to lay out about Henry Ford Boulevard in your opening brief. It had nothing to do with this disparity point. The point about the receptors is there.
Yes. Yes. And also in the comments.
Anything further? Okay, thank you, Mr. Yonke.
Thank you very much.
Captain, thank you. Case is submitted.